I'm delighted to have with me today Dr. Sam White, a GP and whistleblower. Sam, you were suspended by the NHS for speaking out and raising concerns about informed consent, the safety of the injections, and other safe and effective alternative treatments for the disease known as COVID-19. You were particularly worried about the plan to jab children. You were restrained by the GMC from discussing the COVID-19 pandemic on social media for allegedly spreading misinformation regarding the matter. You appealed to the High Court, who overturned the decision to ban you. Could you tell me a little about your background and why you wanted to be a doctor? Then please tell us of the events leading up to your decision to publicly cast doubt over the measures that were being used to contain the pandemic.
Yeah, and it's sort of working class, you know, upbringing. My dad was in the ambulance service. I mean, he had to work 80, 90 hours a week just to keep food on the table. It was pretty tough. They're not very well paid now, but it was very low paid then. And my mum was a nurse. And I guess I wanted to follow in similar footsteps. And watched a bit too much ER back in the day when I was a young teenager and thought, I want to be a doctor. And then I ended up going to Cardiff University. I had a few offers from different medical schools. So I felt like I, you know, fitted in pretty well there. And then, so I spent about 11 years in Cardiff in total doing my undergraduate and postgraduate training. And then in 2010 became a GP back in Hampshire. And I've been doing that until fairly recently, and I've made a transition to independent practice into integrative, or otherwise known as functional medicine, particularly in the US. And that's more rewarding for me personally as a doctor, and I think for patients also it can be. And you're looking really at the underlying reasons why people get chronically sick. And when I struggled with my health with fatigue quite a few years ago, I wasn't getting the answers I needed in the allopathic system. So I started exploring, and I eventually found the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, which takes a kind of big picture approach to the role of things like chronic infection in the manifestation of chronic diseases that particularly we see in the West. And I remember going to see a functional physician myself. And at the end of the consultation I had with me, I said, how do you know all this? Because I don't. And he said, well, you need to go and train here. And that's what I did as I got, you know, better myself. And, you know, I gradually thought that would be something I would go into. Obviously, I needed to start a lot quicker when my ability to earn money in the NHS was cut abruptly short last year for talking about my experience and what I knew and scientific facts, information about really the entire response or the narrative that people have been told. And we're now into the third year of this. And when there was the announcement of a pandemic, at first I thought, wow, you know, and remember back then the predicted mortality was very high, much more so than influenza. So I wasn't scared personally for my own health. You know, I just thought we'd just step up to it, just do it. And there were some very strange things happening, like, you know, the doors to the surgery would be closed and anyone who had respiratory symptoms wasn't allowed in. And that's strange because I've always, as a doctor, seen people with respiratory, you know, disease, quite horrendous pneumonias who end up having to go into hospital. You know, it's never been like that. And within those first few weeks, I volunteered to go and work at what was called a Red Hub in Hampshire. And that was really, it was a lot less than I thought it would be. I thought it would be somewhere where there would be testing and treatment and all this. And then I realised there was nothing there apart from the only thing really useful was an oxygen monitor. So if someone's oxygen levels were low, you would say, well, they need to go into hospital. And the first day I went, this is in very early lockdown, the roads were empty, I drove there, everyone was in the house, sunny day, but people were losing their jobs, their businesses, their livelihoods. The whole entire economy and people's lives was on self-destruct by the powers that be. And yet I didn't see a single patient in that clinic. It was empty. So I went back again the following week, and I didn't see a single patient with respiratory symptoms. So that's when I began to think, hang on, this is not right what we're being told. This doesn't add up. It's not fitting any clinical context that I can interpret. And then we saw things like the rollout of the PCR test, which is a scientific test. At best, it's a medical aid in conjunction with clinical assessment. It should not be used alone to diagnose anything like this. It should not be used in someone who is asymptomatic, because if you do that, you're just going to get a very high percentage of false positives. So people who don't have any condition, people who we'd otherwise, you know, would have said, oh, you're healthy and well. And yet all the while, there was this massive fear narrative and propaganda. And we later learned that it's essentially military grade psychological warfare, which has been applied to the population. And the most egregious of that is those that are vulnerable, you know, the elderly and then the children. And we see that happening now more so than ever. So people were living in fear. They were wearing masks, which I didn't do. The only time I wore a mask was when I called a patient into the room, because I didn't want to get complaints left, right and centre, because that takes a lot of time to deal with, and I didn't usually get complaints. And I would take every opportunity during a consultation and say, you don't need to wear that for my benefit, and certainly not for yours, because there's very real harms from wearing a mask. And we knew from the first SARS virus at the beginning of the century that masks do nothing for aerosolized virus. Okay, this is not a virus that's spread by droplets. A surgeon in theatre is concerned that he wears a mask so that droplets, if he sneezes or coughs, you know, and droplets are there, that it would go into an abdominal or a body viscous of some sort where he's the operating field. They have no role in the community, for just in public life generally. And for me, they had very significant and heinous historical connotations with masking, to deliberately dehumanize and shame people and make them live in more fear. So I didn't like seeing what was happening to patients. We knew fairly early on that there were many drug protocols using off-licensed, proven safe medicines that, if given early to someone when they were ill and symptomatic, would be life-saving. And of course, now we think and we know really that, you know, early use of ivermectin would have saved 80% of people. Okay. And, you know, you and I talked earlier about really the miracle that happened in Uttar Pradesh. You know, it's got a massive population, 200 or so million. And they use ivermectin and COVID's not a problem anymore. Okay. And yet we're still in the situation where people in this country cannot get safe early intervention in the community. Bar one treatment, but most doctors I find don't know about it, and that's a simple inhaler. That would be life-saving. And that what's happening, and still happening, we're into the third year now, is the advice is, if you've got COVID, stay at home and basically wait until you can't breathe anymore or your lips go blue, and then you can go into hospital. But by then, you're dealing with the latter stages of infection. It's much more difficult to manage. And I don't know if we know or will ever know how many people died as a result of not receiving early intervention. And of course, if early interventional therapy, safe, simple medicine, could be made available over the counter as it was in India, was available, there would never have been the means by which the government could introduce an experimental injection. okay? And this is very much not a vaccine, okay? When we think of vaccines, we typically think of the entire virus, which has been deadened or weakened or attenuated, and then that's injected to stimulate an immune response. This isn't the entire virus, okay, that's been weakened in any way. It's one protein of about 27 proteins that make up the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. And it just so happens that that protein, the spike protein, is the most damaging part of the virus. When people get really sick and they're having blood clots as a result of a natural infection, that's, we think, is being driven by this protein. And this whole mechanism of delivery, particularly with the mRNA delivery, in the context of no previous safe coronavirus vaccine ever being made, was rolled out, and again, using this, what I refer to as psychological warfare on the population, they were told by people that they trusted, the NHS, the health service, the government, that this was the best and safest thing to do for them and their family. And for me, nothing could be further than the truth. And we're seeing the consequences and effects of that daily. Still, as I say, people can't get treatment apart from if you happen to be 50 years and over, you can have the inhaler budesonide. So if you're 49 and you've got risk factors, that's not much help to you, even though it's very safe. And all you need to do, really, is take a very cursory look at the yellow card reporting system, which is the system we have in the UK, Eurovigilance in Europe, and VAERS in the US. And you can see that this is the most deadly pharmaceutical product ever used. And then for everyone that dies, there's countless more injured. And people need to understand that even when they look at those figures, we know that there's a significant underreporting factor. And people are dying, it seems. Predominantly, there's been an increase in what's called circulatory disease, heart attacks and strokes. What I've seen personally in people coming to me for help is that young women often get neurological effects. And these are really quite horrific neurological effects, such that they cannot walk. And these might have been, so they're perhaps in their 20s or 30s, never at risk of coming to harm from COVID-19 infection, would have the infection, fine. And there's many nutraceuticals, so vitamins that can be used for treatment, even though they won't make ivermectin available, and they could, should, would, and don't want to. They were never at risk, and yet they were told they needed this. And many have done it for a non-clinical reason. Okay, so wanting to go on holiday, I'm not blaming people because they've been coerced. Again, we come back to this psychological operation that's been applied for keeping their job. So the government is saying that you're not worthy of earning a living or putting food on the table if you don't submit to our experiment. We're living in probably the most dangerous of times. And I often think there's many overtures here of what was happening in the 1930s in Germany. We saw the early discharge of frail and vulnerable people, such that the hospitals were empty in preparation for a pandemic which never really arrived. And you have to keep, you know, in context that those who had a diagnosis have had a diagnosis on the basis of a fraudulent test, the PCR, usually. I've struggled to find any truth in what people have been told. And it got to the point where I was having sleepless nights, I was anxious, when the injections were rolled out in December 2020, I said to my colleagues, I'm not getting involved in this. I also said, you'll need a lot of adrenaline because of the known contents, which is polyethylene glycol, polysorbate 80, those things. Many of people in the population will have antibodies already to PEG and therefore at risk of allergic reactions or anaphylaxis. Even when that started happening, they didn't stop the injections. They just said sit in a chair for 20 minutes afterwards. I'm not even sure they do that anymore. And of course, the very first people that were subjected to this were the frail, vulnerable and elderly, those on many medications. Of course, they were never included in the trial. And you've since seen, at that time and throughout, there's not been full disclosure on either the contents, the vaccines, or the side effects. And recently, one of the vaccine manufacturers was made to release a list of side effects, 10 pages long. The injections were rolled out on the basis of 2 months of data. And we're talking about a biological agent, which I can't see how you can test that safely when it would normally take 10 to 12 years. Okay. And certainly in that time, there was enough to say prior to them being introduced that it would be harmful. So if you think what happened with the injection for the first SARS virus, where they only got as far as animal studies, and then it was never rolled out at all, because the animals developed this what we call antibody dependent enhancement, and they got a far worse form of the illness than they would have otherwise done when they were re-exposed to the virus, and they all died. And then even prior to December 2020, we knew that this spike protein was very similar in structure to a protein expressed on the placenta, syncytin. And so you wonder then, well, are people then going to develop antibodies that could cause inflammation of the placenta and cause miscarriage? So that was what was going through my mind, enough to say, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to do this. And then what I later realized in the January was that people were basically being phoned up by external operators, some admin staff in the surgery, and that was their job, to go to these other sites to have this injection, because it couldn't be done on site anyway, because it had to be stored at a very low temperature. And then I was starting to see people be injured and hearing again and again the narrative that they weren't having it for a medical reason. Okay, if you're having a medical intervention, I mean, there's got to be a medical justification for that. Seeing the grandchildren going on holiday isn't one, that's coercion. With the introduction of the Coronavirus Act, we have to think that every aspect of the practice of medicine and medical ethics, well-established laws on informed consent, in the famous case that's quoted quite often is Montgomery, were inverted. So informed consent doesn't matter. And I've got a document, Freedom of Information Request, where the Royal College of GPs acknowledges that the doctor can't give you any advice on long-term effects because they don't know it. That's what it says. I'm not an expert. I was just a regular doctor, small-town doctor, if you like, seeing this and thinking, at what point do people say, no, we're not doing this? And I think that when government acted, what we'll see in time is completely unlawfully with lockdowns, because it doesn't benefit anyone. You know, quarantine is for the sick, okay? Lockdown for healthy people is tyranny. Simple as that in my book. But when they acted unlawfully and asked doctors to go along with it, which there should have been a united front which said, no, get lost. Because our duty is not to you, certainly not to the World Economic Forum, it's to that person who's sitting in the chair in front of us. Okay. And let's say, Ash, you came to see me in December 2020, and no one asked for my opinion because they were all being sent elsewhere. But let's say you came to see me and said, let's have a chat. What do you think of this, doctor? And I would have told you what happened before in the previous experiments. I would have told you I can't give you any medium to long-term side effects. You know, it's a whole book produced by the GMC on good medical practice, which they regard now as unimportant in my experience, because in there is all about informed consent. That doesn't matter to the General Medical Council. I would have said to you, I'm not going to have it. So why would I recommend it to you? Okay? I wouldn't recommend it to my friends or family. So I didn't want my patients having it. Over my dead body, really. So I said, no, I'm out of here, I'm resigning. And I wrote a long letter. I said to one of my friends, you know, when I write my story about what's happened, I'll publish that resignation letter about all of this, because it, sadly, it stood the test of time really well. But a few months afterwards, I didn't work my notice. I went off with stress because I couldn't bear to see what's happening, and that was weaponized against me. You know, it's me being mentally unwell. I challenge anyone who knew anything of the agenda to not feel stress and anxiety about what's going on. And then not just know the agenda, but to ask to be complicit in it.
I read somewhere that the NHS workers were being incentivized to roll out as many COVID injection doses as they could by earning cash for jabs. The figure bandied about was £12.50 a shot. Can you clarify if this was true?
So, I was gone in February 21, because, as I say, I didn't work the 6 months notice. It's 6 months as a partner. Couldn't be there. But you would get the amount you were being paid each month for drawings as a partner. And I could see from the December, January and February drawings that there was a supplementary pay that I wasn't getting. And that was... it looked at that time like it was on an hourly pro rata basis. So what I don't know is if it's now changed to be integrated into a more of a contract thing with the practices. I wouldn't know on that. But that, yeah, it was certainly incentivized. And that's not unreasonable to say, yeah, GPs should be paid to do extra work. But I remember I returned a few months later as a locum, because I knew as a locum I wouldn't have to get involved. I only lasted 3 days. And I remember saying to one of the GPs, he said, oh, why did you resign as a partner? You know, what he was saying was, it's a good job. It was a nice place where I was working. Really nice village, lovely patients. I said, well, it's the vaccine. And he thought I meant because of the extra workload. So... of course, he's talking to me behind his mask, and I'm just sat there drinking a coffee. And he says, well, it was a lot of work, you know, but I think patients would be very grateful that we did it. And when the wider population public realise what's happened to them, what's potentially happened to their children, they're not going to be happy at all.
Last year, I spoke with the whistleblowing funeral director, John O'Looney. He stated that he was present at a meeting with Sir Graham Brady, a senior Conservative MP, along with yourself and several other professionals from the fields of law, medicine and science. In that meeting, he said that the eminent Professor Dolores Cahill, who was also in attendance and has a doctorate in immunology, stated that anyone who got one of these mRNA injections would have a life expectancy of about 2 to 5 years. That is a horrific prognosis by any account. How dangerous do you consider these mRNA jabs to be at this moment in time compared to when you first raised the alarm about them?
It's worse than I first thought. And it seems to get worse as each day goes on, as I learn more. And there's been so many days since my resignation, since it was rolled out, where I was convinced it would be withdrawn. how many deaths do they need? How many people have got to die? How many young people? How many people have got to lose their loved ones to a failed, heinous experiment on people where there's, you know, laws are just being broken willfully, okay? And, you know, we talked before about the raised D-dimer issue, which is a marker for blood clots. And Dr. Charles Hoff in Canada reported last summer, and I chatted with him, that he was seeing within the first 2 weeks a raised D-dimer in around 65% of patients. And yet there wasn't any corresponding scan result which suggested that there was a blood clot. So his hypothesis was that this was small clots happening. And then he was saying about patients were getting so fatigued walking to the surgery just to see him. And so their lungs had these very small clots, which were happening more globally, perhaps throughout the lung, but not in a big space that could be identified on a CT scan. But then there was a German pathologist who did a series of autopsies. And when I say that the practice of medicine was basically completely inverted with the Coronavirus Act, postmortems were stopped. Okay, so if there is the introduction of something novel, or you need to know what's gone wrong, why people are dying, that's probably the most important thing you would need to be doing. Okay, it's not nice for the families to have to go through that process, but in terms of protecting people, you need to know how that person died if you want to stop others, and you've got a new experimental therapy, treatment, mistake, disaster. So there was a German pathologist, and there was a series of patients who weren't thought to have died from having had the vaccine. And the initial pathological examination didn't show anything vaccine related. And that was a macroscopic, so what the pathologist would see with their eyes. So he went back and he did basically under the microscope. And he was finding numerous bodily organs were infiltrated and destroyed with this spike protein. And that was found way early on with the Japanese biodistribution study. You know, because some of the people that were advocating for this injection were saying it stays in your arm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it doesn't. It goes to the ovaries, it goes to the heart, it goes wherever the receptor is for the spike protein. That receptor, commonly referred to as the ACE2 receptor. Okay. So it goes everywhere. And if you're injecting something into the arm, it's going to go into the bloodstream. Okay. So the immunoglobulin that's going to be affected is one called the circulatory IgA, immunoglobulin A. IgA is your first line of defense, you know, against infection. When we're stressed, when our cortisol goes up, our IgA goes down, we become more susceptible to infection. Teachers are classic, okay? So teachers work all term, really stressed out, look forward to half term, and then suddenly it just, you know, and they're just basically running on adrenaline and cortisol. You see that all the time. I should write about it. It's phenomenal. And if you've got it in the circulatory IgA, this vaccine that's meant to protect you, that's not going to work, because you need it in the secretory IgA. Where's that? It's in your mucosal surfaces, so in the respiratory tract and in the gut. So it's in the wrong place to start with. So it's never meant to work. Okay, and then it's going to your bodily organs. And one of the most worrying things for me from those autopsy findings, and Dr. Ryan Cole, who's an American pathologist and part of America's frontline doctors, he's identified this as well, is that this spike protein, this toxic spike protein, is infiltrating the lymphocytes. And they would be also our white blood cells that would fight off infection and cancer. And he's reporting a massive increases in cancer. And if you look at the US Department of Defense database. I think it's been withdrawn now. I can't access it publicly. There's increases in diseases of extraordinary magnitude, including cancer, including miscarriage as well. Last time I checked, the usual quarterly report for stillbirths and miscarriages hasn't been published by the ONS since March 21. Around a similar time that pregnant women were being injected. This is all encompassing. And as you know, when I went public with my concerns, I was very, very quickly silenced. And first, the NHS suspended me by emergency order. And then the GMC did as well. And that emergency order, i.e. you get a phone call one day, you can't work anymore, you can't get paid, was cited as being for the protection of the public because I was a risk and a danger to the public. And that's been a pattern that's been repeated in this country. And we talked about Dr. Mohammed Adil as well, who got there before me with being suspended and treated awfully. And that's been a pattern that's been repeated around the world, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the US, the Five Eyes countries, as I, you know, refer to them as. And there's been very concerted attempts to pathologize dissent. So these people, the regulators, what I've realized is, so they'll say, you know, they're to protect the public and guide doctors. Well, that's nonsense. They've done none of that. You know, the executive board of the NHS, the Care Quality Commission, they care not that the public are being experimented on, denied access to treatment. What they do care for is silencing anyone who challenges an official narrative, which is an evil one, a very evil one. And so what I found very quickly was that when I had my initial, and I call it a kangaroo court hearing, because that's what it was, and my barrister afterwards said to me, that was a farce. They started off by saying, we don't consider evidence. What they meant was, we don't want to. Because I had submitted over 1,000 pages, in a couple of weeks. They bring it forward very quickly. Actually, everyone came forward to support me. Peter McCullough, Mike Yeadon, Dr. Urso, literally everyone came forward, wrote expert witness reports, and they were already preparing them. Like, oh, yeah, we'll help Sam. He's been speaking out, and apparently it was a brave thing to do. I didn't know it was brave at the time. I'm still not convinced it should be brave. And all the GMC had, and their barrister spoke for about 20 minutes, basically it was 18 anonymised complaints, which said that I was spouting misinformation. And this is straight, as I said before, out of the Rules for Radicals communist playbook. That's what they do. And then they said that I was exhibiting paranoid and disinhibited behaviour, which, as any doctor knows, implies that you have a severe disorder of your mental health.
In order to make such claims about you exhibiting paranoid and disinhibited behaviour, did the GMC provide an expert witness such as a doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, or other healthcare professional? And if so, did this witness actually carry out an examination of your mental health in order for the GMC to make such claims?
What they did was they put this gagging order on me at this first tribunal where I couldn't speak about any aspect of the pandemic on social media or anywhere, or associated aspects. So my solicitor sought clarification. And he said, well, what if Sam's walking on a beach and he sees a mask littering and he posts, you know, isn't it terrible to see litter there? And the response from the GMC was, you know what will happen to your client. And they said that in order to bring this to trial, because of all the delays, because of COVID, they required 18 months. So I'd be suspended with no pay for 18 months. So I'd be bankrupt by then. A lot less time than that. But in that time, they were going to get me to a psychiatrist and have a formal psychiatric assessment. But they didn't have any evidence to bring that about, other than the thousands of pages of evidence I'd submitted saying what I'd said in my video that went viral was based in scientific fact and evidence. And it was all about destroy the messenger, because actually the message is pretty sound. That was a big problem for them. And then you know, various things have happened since. A few weeks later, I was asked to appear on the Corona Investigative Committee, which was being held in Berlin with Dr. Rainer Formick and Viviana and Dr. Wolfgang Vordag. Dr. Vordag, as you know, exposed the H1N1 scam and the vaccines, which went on to cause narcolepsy, I believe, in a number of patients, never recovered from that. And I went on there to talk about what doctors were experiencing if they spoke out. And on that basis, for sharing what they said was my conspiracy views with Dr. Ryan Formick and his committee, I was referred back to another tribunal hearing as an emergency proceeding. Luckily, we got that postponed on account of an appeal that was pending in the High Court, which was to be fought against tribunal and the General Medical Council on the basis of freedom of speech. That was the day I was in court, was the 4th of November. And on that same day, the NHS, and there was about 15 members of this committee in attendance, had this secret meeting. And they say they invited me, but they sent it to an email address, which was an NHS email address I could no longer access because I'd left. They suspended me. They didn't contact me in any other way, my website or my solicitor. So they went ahead and it was, you know, paranoid, disinhibited, and see if we can persuade him to go to a doctor. And I've got a recording of the phone call from June where this GP and senior clinical advisor is telling me that I'm ill. And I actually said to him in this recording, the recording was released as part of the court hearing, you know, documents, the transcript. I said, if I was poorly, mentally or, you know, physically, do you not think I would, you know, not go to a doctor? She says, yes, I don't think you would go. I said, okay. So, but I later, obviously, in early December, got the news that I'd won in the High Court and that the GMC had breached my human right to be a part of society and allowed to have freedom of speech. Okay. It was quite funny in court, in a way, looking back. Because the GMC side was all masked up. And there was my team, which I had an expert witness, barrister, solicitor. And we were all just normally, because we don't regard each other as biohazards, like the population has been taught to do because of psychological warfare. So my barrister spoke for 2 hours uninterrupted, which is incredible. To be honest, it was easy to tear apart their argument. It still is. And the judge was visibly angry and annoyed with the GMC bench. And he shouted at one point, he wasn't telling them to drink bleach. You know, he was telling them not to be an experiment. And the GMC barrister interrupted, was speaking for about 45 minutes. Now, the problem is that our judicial system, I'm starting to realise, particularly with what's transpired since with the police investigation.
Can you tell us about the police investigation you mentioned for those viewers who might not have heard about it as a result of the mainstream media blackout and censorship of anything against the government narrative? I understand that the investigation was meant to look into mRNA COVID-19 vaccine-related corporate crimes and threats to public health, including misfeasance and misconduct in public office and corporate manslaughter. Incidentally, on the 22nd of February 2022, The Metropolitan Police decided that no further action would be taken.
So on the back of that victory, we kind of hit back. And earlier in July, we'd already released a public disclosure letter to Sir Simon Stevens, who was the chief executive for the NHS. It was about 21, 22 pages. You can probably still find it on the internet, outlining all of the government lies and the fact that what was happening to the population was wrong. So we then wrote to the new CEO. We didn't get a reply. We've written to Boris and Sajid as well about their conflicts of interest. No reply. And then we wrote to the new CEO of the NHS, Amanda Pritchard, and said, well, this is what's transpired in those few months since. This is how many more people have died. How many deaths is going to be, are you okay with? You know, didn't get a reply. We did get a reply to that. But yeah, it was meaningless. And it was just, yeah, it wasn't a reply to the 20 odd pages again. And then we also wrote to say, why did you treat myself one way and Hillary Jones another? So Hillary Jones goes on GMTV and says the vac equals a vaccine. It's win-win-win-win-win, you know. And someone had written to the General Medical Council, a number of people, because over 4,000, I think, had complained to Ofcom. And he's saying that to millions. And the General Medical Council said, well, you know, he's entitled to his own opinion or something like that. And they missed the, you know, correct test of what the person was actually complaining about. They were saying that what he was saying was dangerous. And it is. It still is. So we wrote publicly about that, so that all the over the internet, to kind of trying to do our bit to contribute it to an awakening. We went to the police in December, I think it was around the 20th of December. The first police station were not interested in, which is London. So the crimes were being committed in London, Parliament. So we went to London, to the Met Police. And Charing Cross were not interested at all. We went to Hammersmith instead. And we sat down with police constable for about 6 hours and gave oral evidence, really, which he noted down. And we alleged that the NHS, the General Medical Council and the MHRA were misconducting themselves in public office and corporate manslaughter. So the MHRA is, for people who don't know, is the drugs and medicines regulator in the UK. Receives money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, of course, like the BBC does. So they've willfully denied access to safe therapeutics, apart from budesonide, if you're over 50 and your doctor knows about it. And they've approved what they call as a vaccine on the basis of not proving that the SARS-CoV-2 virus ever exists. And Dr. Massey, as you know, has written to over 170 organisations around the world asking for proof of isolation and purification. That's never been provided. That was one of the many pieces of evidence that we submitted to the police. So the police then gave us a secure upload facility to submit to the detective team and CID that were then taking on the role of investigating. So over a 2-month period, on nearly a daily basis, we were uploading evidence. And that covered everything in terms of the Coronavirus Act and everything that happened at the hands of those organisations. And if you think about the MHRA, one thing that we discussed when I was last on the Corona Investigative Committee, which was December, with Dr. Vordag, was that there's this hot lot issue as well, or toxic batch. So some batches of the vaccine are killing more, way more than others. They look like they were switching. So for instance, I've got one patient who had two Pfizer injections and then was unable to walk. And there is a website where you can check whether your batch is one of those very toxic batches. And she had two toxic batches. So if that information is in the public domain, if the public can see, via VAERS in particular, that some batches are more dangerous than others, The MHRA can see it, and yet they haven't instigated a recall of all of them to check on that issue at all. Now, I happen to think they're all dangerous, but some are very much more dangerous than others.
Why do you think it is that some batches are more dangerous than others? Are the dangers to do with different ingredients in the jabs, or the amount of certain harmful contents, or perhaps a combination of both ingredients and amounts?
When I spoke to Dr. Wolf Wardag, it's the 31st of December, I was on there last, and Dr. Mike Yeadon has been through it really thoroughly with his team, and he's very, very knowledgeable about it. He's an expert in this field in particular, about making safe pharmaceuticals. And he thinks almost that they're doing like a toxic dose study. So the dose is changed within each vial, each batch, so that they're seeing potentially how much is required to injure or kill someone. Very much experimental, very much evil. And yet still, not only is it not being withdrawn, they're now saying it's good for kids to have this as well. So children have all had, you know, they've nearly all had it. They've got a very active thymus gland. Probably didn't even notice they had it. There is no benefit to them having, you know, any healthy child, there's no benefit to them having this injection, and every risk, every harm. And that's already being given to 5 to 11 year olds. And I wanted to stop it long ago, or not even introduce it, but now they'll be the 6 months old and up next.
By March 2022, most of the coronavirus restrictions in the UK were lifted. And since then, many of the British public have been behaving as if the past 2 years of tyranny are over. Even those who claim to have been awake for much of those 2 years appear to have been lulled into a false sense of optimism. We have an economy in tatters, poverty on the rise, food shortages, an energy crisis, precedents set for tyranny, and thousands injured or killed by lockdowns through coerced medical treatments. Resistance to the UK biosecurity state has become bogged down in challenging the justification for the lockdown and rightfully proving the dangers of the injections. But there is a reluctance to look at what these programs have prepared us for. We may well be in a far worse situation where we're living in a totalitarian state without many even realizing it. How can anyone in their right mind believe that we are out of the woods when, although restrictions were lifted, on the 28th of March 2022, the NHS began offering 5 to 11-year-olds COVID shots?
I don't know what goes through the mind of a doctor or nurse who does this. A cursory look at the yellow card system, which we know there's massive underreporting. You just got to take a quick look at that and you'll say, well, something's off here, at the least. And what about, for instance, when the care home workers were mandated to get this? Okay. If you're a doctor or a nurse, okay, and you've got a care home worker in front of you, how do you know they're not there because they're being coerced because of a mandate? I put it to you, you don't. You couldn't do. And we've got this issue where doctors are following guidance. Okay, so the guidance from the NHS, from anyone who wishes to decline a injection, decline to give their consent, there's only about four conditions from which you can derive, according to this guidance, an exemption. So I was turned down for an exemption. So we wrote to my doctors, you know, the GP that I'm registered with, and said, don't give my consent for this. Is that not battery? Okay. And they've all moaned to the British Medical Association, which is joke, because the law is a long way above guidance. But they're trapped, the doctors are trapped in this catch-22 position where they're being paid by a contract that says they must follow this rules, And if they don't, or if they challenge it, if they speak out, they're going to lose their job. Because just prior to my high court victory, the General Medical Council, via the medical press, was putting out there that you will likely lose your job, be suspended, if you speak out against the vaccines.
With the looming threat of serious sanctions being imposed upon doctors who refuse to jab their patients on the one hand, and the possibility of criminal action being taken against them for not providing informed consent on the other, do you believe this catch-22 position doctors find themselves in is causing more of them to wake up, or are most just going along with the whole agenda without question?
That's going to be the case for some, certainly. Many of the doctors and nurses will be victims because they would have had it, and we don't know what the long-term effects will be. But there is, in my personal experience, what I see is those that are highly educated, the professionals, lawyers, doctors. I mean, I was nearly thrown off a Lufthansa flight recently for having a mask exemption, and the pilot didn't want to accept the letter of exemption. And he threatened me. He said, you know, he wasn't going to put other passengers at risk. And then the air hostess came and asked me, why was I even flying if I couldn't wear a mask? You know, so they're also victims of this psychological warfare. And I think if you're clever, you're highly educated, the big problem is that you think you would never fall for propaganda. Whereas in actual fact, because you have that belief, you're more susceptible to it. So thinking that you're reading the Times, the medical journals, and we know that papers were retracted from the Lancet regarding the use of hydroxychloroquine, which is very safe, very effective. And yet when they had the Holby trial in Oxford, instead of using 400 milligrams a day, which is the recommended dose, they used 2,400. And then a paper was produced to say it was toxic and not good for you and could cause heart problems. Well, any drug will cause, you know, problems, side effects, lethality when used in toxic doses. So the propaganda has been severe, overwhelming, and thinking that you're educated and doctors are held high in the public esteem. I always prefer people to call me Sam most of the times. I don't really like it, you know. But I think there's a sense that you will never fall victim to propaganda. And yet now more than ever, because of the role of big tech, this is like Goebbels on steroids. Wow, yeah. You know, and the repetition of lies is so much more because of, you know, the internet, you know, and social media and things. I mean, there's also a lot of good there as well, because people like me would never have a platform otherwise. I mean, I don't have a big platform because I'm shadow banned and all those things, of course. And the day I won my victory in the High Court for freedom of speech was the day Twitter stopped me using Twitter. Almost like they knew.
I'd like to return to the police investigation into jab injuries and deaths that your team alleged were caused by misfeasance and misconduct in public office and corporate manslaughter. There was a huge amount of optimism with regards to the outcome of the case, especially with the amount of witness statements both from those injured by the jabs as well as expert witnesses providing supporting documents to the investigation. The investigation appeared to fizzle out like a damp squib. Can you take us through your side of events as you saw them?
All of the greats, as I think of in medicine, we had over 40 expert witnesses, RFK Jr. as well, Peter McCullough, Mike Eden, everyone. So we had over 40 expert witnesses. None of them were contacted. None of us four complainants were interviewed. And from one small law firm, we had hundreds and hundreds of victim statements. We had a small team working overtime. We had experts in statistics and actuary. None of those victims were brought in to be interviewed. And I think, Ash, that before we instigated that investigation, I did question myself, can you get justice in the justice system? Yeah. And we know that the entire, you know, police, judiciary, it's all a corporate debt-based slave structure. We go back to the birth certificate fraud and trespass that happens when we're first brought into the world. But part of me felt, for a good while, whilst that two-month process was going on, that the evidence was so much. And I should say as well that one part of the evidence was an independent investigation which I'd raised a lot of money. Most of it's still there. Because we were going to go by the police. And then, so we did an independent investigation into the contents of these vaccines, because we were fearful that there were all these deaths happening, and do we know what's really in them? And are we being told the truth? Because remember, these drug companies are serial felons. They paid billions and billions in fines over the years. And so we had a GP surgery cooperate with us. And the chain of custody from the vials leaving the GP surgery to the lab we'd commissioned was overseen and filmed, documented by former Murder Squad detectives to ensure that that chain of custody would stand up in a courtroom. And then we've published an analysis which was put up on UK Citizen 2021, 88-page document of what was found in there, including the presence of graphene oxide. Okay, so that's certainly not something that's disclosed. That's certainly not something that the doctors would know was in there. There's no business that being in there, in anything that's injected into the human body. For a start, it's DNA damaging. It's very toxic to have that there. So that was one small piece of evidence.
Did you find any other ingredients that had no business, as you aptly put it, being in any of the vials?
We're still waiting on the full forensic analysis. So that was 88 pages. There's going to be more. But the evidence was, as I say, for 2 months there was almost a daily continual upload of evidence, quality evidence, being checked by statisticians, actuaries, as well as scientists. And then we, as the four complainants, each got a letter at the same time. Superintendent, I believe, 3/4 of a page, saying no evidence of wrongdoing. Basically nothing to see here. Meanwhile, the day before, there was an escalation into investigation into me, which is just more harassment, really, which I've come to realise.
Can you tell us what the investigation into you was all about?
So that was the Care Quality Commission saying that I hadn't registered my services as a functional doctor with them. Now, I'm registered now with the General Naturopathic Council and the Association of Naturopathic Practitioners. So when my video was released and went viral, because they knew I was in functional medicine, they offered me free membership for a year, actually. And when I won in the High Court, they published, you know, it's a great victory. They couldn't have been more supportive. And they know full well, and they've reassured me that naturopathic physicians don't need to be registered with the Care Quality Commission. And as I said, I haven't seen much evidence of them caring about what's happening right now. But that was a letter which informed me that I could be liable to 12 months in prison or an unlimited fine for not registering my services with them. Didn't give much of a reason other than that. Yeah, and that was the day before the police closed down the investigation. It's hard to think that that's a coincidence, because otherwise there's been a lot of strange coincidences since I spoke out. I haven't gone into the half of it, you know. But I realise now why people say, oh, you're brave, because I didn't think it was brave at all. And I still don't think it should be. But I will say to doctors and nurses who are worried about coming forward that you will find that your universe puts the people in your life at the right time, at the right moment. to support you. And I wouldn't change what I did in terms of resigning, not getting involved, despite what's happened to me, despite the threats to me and my livelihood and everything. I wouldn't want to be waking up to the realization of what I've been a part of. And my whole philosophy is, as someone who's very much a true libertarian in the sort of Austrian school of thought in that sense, government should be small, local, accountable to the people it serves, and have very little involvement in people's lives. And we see the complete opposite of that, as you said, sort of totalitarianism.
It's clear to me that the elites view themselves as gods, bestowing and extinguishing life at will. The unelected WEF technocrats have anointed themselves transhuman demigods and bestowed upon themselves the concomitant ultimate power. They treat us adults as infants, discouraging personal responsibility and accountability. They want to micromanage every little aspect of our lives whilst getting us to outsource completely to experts. With adults behaving like infants, it's the children who have suffered more than any other group.
I think we'll see massive developmental delay in children. I'm sure it's being realised now. I mean, there's the issue with the masks, so there's no benefit whatsoever for anyone, let alone a child, in whom, when it's measured, the retention of carbon dioxide goes well above accepted dangerous levels. And that's not going to be good for a child's brain, or the development to what we call neuroplasticity of a child's brain. And it seems to be more poignant in children with the developing brain, up to about 21, 25, really, in a sense.
You spoke earlier of Christine Massey, the biostatistician who made hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests from health departments all over the world, asking if they had evidence of an isolated virus. To date, over 100 institutions from all over the globe have responded, unable to provide evidence in sight of SARS-CoV-2. What she discovered is that all government and medical institutions have hypothetical virus sequences made up on computers called in silico sequences. They exist as computer models only. We've had a CDC spokesperson admit that virologists are unable to find any viruses directly in any fluid of any person or animal, no matter how sick. The only time they can see viruses is in the cell culture created in the lab. Perhaps the truth of the injection catastrophe will never be accepted until the truth of the irrelevance or non-existence or deliberate fabrication of the target illness is also proven and acknowledged. Where do you stand on the existence of SARS-CoV-2 and on the broader question of viruses existing as these exogenous, contagious, disease-causing agents?
So I think a lot of things are going to have to be relearned. I think the lie goes a lot deeper than the last 2 years. And there's a number of things which I think would be revealed where we've perhaps been deceived. I know that over 170 institutions have been written to ask about the issue of isolation and purification. Now, I think there has been a virus because they're quite capable of doing that. And this has the appearance of what's known as a chimeric virus. So a coronavirus typically just causes a cold. But we know here we see a disease which, in those that are vulnerable, those with low vitamin D, frail, overweight, diabetes, it affects them badly, and it tends to cause blood clots in the inflammatory process, and that's when they tend to drop their oxygen levels, when they're throwing off blood clots. So I think there is one. But if you're going to say to the country, to most of the Western world and the Eastern as well, really just sub-Saharan Africa that didn't go along with it, that we're going to lock you in your homes even though you're perfectly well, it might be nice to show evidence that you'd isolated a virus. They ought to be able to do that. And I sort of note with interest that the filing in South Africa is to do with against the government, the president, and also the privately owned central bank, that they failed to prove that it even existed. Now, I think it does, but that's two different things. You should be able to say definitively that it does, and there not be controversy about that.
In the spring of 2020, when the UK went through its first wave of the alleged pandemic, midazolam and morphine were used on patients in vast quantities in care homes across the UK. It has been alleged that these patients had been transferred from hospital into care homes and put on end-of-life care without the consent of their family members, slapped with DNR orders, and administered the aforementioned cocktail of drugs in amounts that may well have killed them. I understand that midazolam suppresses the respiratory system, and it is therefore believed that due to this side effect, the deaths were conveniently misrepresented as COVID, when in fact they were murdered. Firstly, can you tell me what you know about how midazolam should be correctly administered and for what purpose? Secondly, many of those allegedly with COVID, who didn't need invasive mechanical ventilators, were placed on these machines, resulting in a high mortality due to fears that other forms of treatment, such as nebulizers, would have transmitted the virus around the ward. What do you make of the use of ventilators during the alleged pandemic?
When the initial pandemic was announced, the mortality was exaggerated considerably, and there was a great fear among us at the time that what we would be doing predominantly, because there was no treatment, certainly no treatment that was made available, was looking after people who were going to die. And at that time, it looks like the government procured a heck of a lot more midazolam. And there is, I think, freedom of information requests that have shown that the procurement of midazolam literally went through the roof at that time in the early pandemic. Now, if, say, you dislocated your shoulder or perhaps you were going for an endoscopy, you might be given midazolam intravenously, so into your vein. And I remember when I was doing accident and emergency, putting someone's shoulder back in, obviously the muscles are in spasm, person's screaming, you know, because it's absolute agony. You would do that in the resuscitation room. Okay, so they were on a monitor. There would be someone there who, if their breathing was compromised, could get in and protect their airway straight away. And with the midazolam, it's quite easy to do that, just pop it back in. So it has a role and a use, and I think there's been some people who are fearful that there is no use or role for it, but if I had a dislocated shoulder, I'd want that. It has a role in end of life care as well, and end of life care is important because, I mean, one of the things you see in someone who's the final stages of life, perhaps in a lot of pain, riddled with cancer, for instance, is something called terminal agitation. And midazolam is an anxiolytic, so it relieves anxiety. And terminal agitation is not something you want to see. And it might be that they would be given a subcutaneous injection of midazolam to relieve that. And that could be as an acute bolus injection, which is a much lower dose, or over 24 hours via what's called a syringe driver, where there's like this continual infusion to relieve the anxiety, along with other things for symptom management. Now, what was happening in the early stages of the pandemic is that people could be diagnosed remotely as having COVID prior to even there being the introduction of the flawed PCR test. So it was almost like there was a presumption if you had respiratory symptoms. And I don't remember diagnosing anyone with it myself, but there were people in the care homes who could be contacted remotely via the carer or the nurse. And if it was fairly mundane, like, oh, this person's got, you know, dry skin, or they need some antibiotics for a urine infection. But I don't know, because I wasn't, you know, I didn't see it happen myself. I wasn't part of that. Is whether the people were being remotely put on a pathway on the basis that they had a terminal illness. The other thing that ties in with this, is there were guidelines from the NHS that should someone have a positive PCR, which we've already discussed, it was highly likely to be falsely positive because it doesn't test for live virus. Test could be dead virus, can remain positive for weeks and weeks. And if over amplified beyond 24, it's next to meaningless. And it seems later transpired that the labs were using, you know, these labs that were put up that weren't being run by really qualified staff. They were lighthouse labs, and we've got someone who came forward about that. People were being given this diagnosis then of COVID, but the NHS guidelines were, if you have a positive PCR, do not give antibiotics. The other initial guidance was, don't give steroids because you could kill them. Okay, so there was every incentive not to give anyone any treatment that would be curative. Because if you've got, say, a positive PCR, that might mean you've got COVID, which is a virus, but it might also mean you've got a bacterial pneumonia, for which you need antibiotics. So if you're assessing someone remotely, it makes it even worse. And then let's say, I don't know this for sure, my communication networks with doctors has all ceased. You know, probably mutually beneficial in that way. But if, say, someone was being remotely contacted about someone frail and vulnerable, making a diagnosis then of COVID, there not being any treatment, then the next stage might be an end-of-life pathway. And it seems that, and I give the example of locally, where you would wait, you know, to go to accident emergency as an emergency, you might be in an ambulance with the paramedics for 12 hours in the wintertime because it's packed. And yet we were seeing the numbers of beds that were free, like 250. So those people must have been discharged really, really early, probably with acute infection. Then if they were symptomatic, perhaps passing it on to other frail, vulnerable people, and many could have been saved with having high dose vitamin D. If you're in a nursing or a care home, you're not getting sunlight, and you live in the UK, there's not much sunlight here anyway. And then being remotely consulted with, potentially the doctor's not allowed or to go and see them, and then if a few months into that, when the PCR was introduced, then being told, you know, there's no steroids which can reduce inflammation and things, particularly in the lungs, and reduce the systemic inflammation, or antibiotics when there might be a bacterial infection, the outcome is not going to be good. It's going to be the opposite. And then the next step, next day or so, might be to say, well, they deteriorated, doesn't look like they're going to make it. And this could all be been done remotely, but this was the government's and the NHS senior executives saying, you know, you've got to do all you can remotely. At the same time, the procurement of midazolam skyrocketed. Okay, and at the same time, you spoke to John O'Looney, he'll tell you that 95% of deaths result in cremation. Okay, so if there's foul play, then there's no evidence. Okay. And ordinarily, if you were doing cremation paperwork, it would be the GP who looked after the patient in their final days, and then a GP who doesn't know the patient from another practice to check everything, to check there's no foul play. But the Coronavirus Act scrapped the requirement for a Part 2 doctor. So let's say you've got some bad actors as doctors. We know that's happened before. That's what Shipman was. And there was one locally as well, popping people off with morphine. Gospel, I forget the name now. I mean, vast majority of doctors go into medicine because they care about people. Everything was done to kind of make it so that people couldn't be assessed, they couldn't get treatment, they couldn't get diagnosis. And at the same time, midazolam procurement's going through the roof.
In the United States, midazolam is used for lethal injection of prisoners on death row. Midazolam was actively prescribed to elderly patients during the pandemic, clearly as a result of the lockdown rules, without proper medical assessment. Am I right in suggesting that this drug depresses the respiratory system and therefore hastens death? If it does, then surely you wouldn't use midazolam for someone with COVID where the respiratory system is under attack.
Unless someone was actually dying and terminally agitated. And if you think that COVID-19, as I do, well, it is more treatable than flu, if you get early intervention into that person, chances are you're not going to end up at that stage, because I think we could have saved 80% of people. And that's what the data shows with ivermectin. So if you get it into them in the first day or so, what you're doing is you're reducing the replication of the virus. Okay. And the other thing is, I got about vitamin D, is the admissions to ITU, I think, would have been reduced by about 80% had people been had proper vitamin D levels. And if you're frail or vulnerable, you're not going out. You can't. You're incapacitated. So your natural vitamin D is very low. The amount given to you on prescription is naff. So an hour of sunshine is 10,000 international units. Okay. Eventually, people were given 400 if they were vulnerable. Well, that's not going to do anything. And at the same time, the NHS protocol was, and this was submitted to the police, I did a witness statement just on vitamin D alone, and said, do not offer vitamin D for prevention or treatment of COVID-19. Okay. Just the whole thing. I mean, I go from rage to wanting to break down in tears, just so angry. Because, you know, the British have done this in other places around the world, this level of cruelty. But to their own people, and we never thought it would happen. And we're going to be dealing with the consequences of this for generations.
The state and its handlers have set a precedent for convincing healthy people that they may be secretly sick. They then convince them to get tested with an inappropriate test to confirm the secret illness. This was followed by giving them an injection that actually makes them sick. They got them to test again so that they could blame the virus. They then offered them a booster that made them sick again. The person tested again to lay blame on the virus. Although many have stopped this behaviour, you feel it wouldn't take more than another government fear campaign to get plenty of the public to start complying again. Maybe not due to this virus, but another manufactured crisis. We've seen this time and again in our recent past, though not on this scale, such as with HIV.
But Diana changed that overnight, and that's why I say you don't need to be treating people like biohazards.
When children are ill, we shouldn't isolate them for fear of catching or getting their illness. What we should be doing is hugging them and helping them to alleviate any fear or anxiety they may have as a result of feeling unwell. It's astonishing to watch adults being afraid of their children as these toxic biohazards who might have made them ill, when in all likelihood it's the toxins in their bodies from their lifestyle that made them sick with symptoms trying to actually heal them. It comes back to the notion of adults not wanting to take self-responsibility for their actions and behaviours. To make matters worse, these adults poisoned themselves by suppressing symptoms with drugs and shots, preventing the mechanisms in the body to work as designed in order to create symptoms that push out the waste.
Well, I think it was Chris Whitty that said that, you know, grandchildren visiting their grandparents could kill them. I mean, that's pure evil. Because what I saw in that 9 months I was still there for the pandemic was a massive deterioration in cognitive and executive function of patients with dementia because of the lack of social interaction. Depression and anxiety was through the roof. people were losing their jobs, their businesses, they weren't seeing their friends and family. And now they've created, by design, an apartheid in society between, I like to say, those that are awake, not woke, because that's very different, okay? That woke means you can't talk about most things. But between the awakened who realised, either because they got it early on that this was all a lie and fraud, or because they've been harmed themselves or they know someone who's been harmed. Because if you think logically about it, most of us don't necessarily know someone who's come to harm from COVID, because it does, after all, have an incredibly low infection fatality rate, about 0.2%. But most of us know of someone who's either died or been injured by the experiment. But I will say that what this is doing is waking people up to a reality that is incredibly painful and is going to be. But where I see, and like I say, people who come into my life to help me when I needed it, I see the future being very good, well-intentioned people coming together to create new, better systems. We showed that the police were not serving the interests of the public, okay? We'll wait for the Independent Office of Police Complaints to reply and respond. I don't know that it's necessarily and truly independent, so we might have to go for an injunction, but I don't think we can beat them in their system. So we need to almost build like a parallel world.
You mentioned that you've seen some positive signs from the forces that are countering the mainstream narrative and this war on humanity. One such positive sign I've seen myself emerged from an article by the Daily Exposé stating that a UK government report admitted that 18.9 million people hadn't yet taken a single dose of a COVID-19 shot, and there were 30.5 million who weren't going to take another one. This suggests that people are waking up, albeit slowly. Of course, the concern remains that many who are now awake to the COVID con may get roped into the climate con. What have been the positive signs that you've seen, and how confident do those signs make you feel about the trajectory in which we're headed?
You could see how they were going to conflate COVID with climate change and create food shortages, fuel, you know, inflation, destruction of the economy. It's that order out of chaos that these evil people strive for. I'm certainly aware of organisations which are being formed. One, the People's Health Alliance, more recently, where you're going to see good people do incredible things. And that will be not this, there's an allopathic system and there's a naturopathic system, but where they're working together. And it's okay to work together. And it's okay for naturopathic doctors to say that they diagnose and treat people, because at the moment they're not, under the regulations. Okay, there's another one, Tess Laurie's working on similar organisation that bring that. And I've posted about it recently because they've asked me to be an ambassador. And there's lots of excitement among people. There's going to be a children's health defence for the UK. You know, excited to be on the board for that. That's going to have a massive impact in helping parents decide what's best for their children so that they can overcome or at least have a counter narrative to the propaganda and the fear, and also be UK based. I've via someone who was vaccine injured, spent some time overseas, about a month, with a professor, and I've seen miracles happen with a treatment that he's had for quite a few years, and he's been using it for other things. It can treat multiple things. It doesn't have side effects, remarkably. It's really quite an ingenious thing, and I'm not allowed to talk about it at the moment because we have to find a way to get it to the public safely without being closed down by the regulators, who really have the agenda of Big Pharma and the government, to hand, not the interests of the people. I don't think it would be long. I've got meetings next week with people who would be interested in not necessarily being investors, but being donors. Because actually they say they want to put their money to good use. They've hated what's happening. You know, I think that will be combined because I'm building with someone. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about who it is because she's fairly well known. But it'd be a retreat. It'd be a health retreat because people have been physically, psychologically and spiritually demeaned and tortured, especially in the last 2 years. So we're going to need healing centres, and that one we're doing would be one of many. Mark my word, because there's people who want to make a better world for us, definitely, and I want to be a part of that for sure. And and that includes other things like finance. You know, really we're just using debt instruments, which are, because we use them, we're charged usury, and so tax is really just usury. You know, that money is going to pay interest to the private owners of the central banks. It's not going to pay for the NHS, that's funded on debt. You know, it's all a promise to pay. There's no capital in the system, it's not capitalism, it's crony capitalism. And I think we'll see a return to, you know, asset-backed money rather than currency, which will have a massive difference for people's quality of life. Yeah, controlling inflation, because, you know, when Nixon came off the gold standard and inflation went through the roof, and all of a sudden both parents have to work. You know, it's great if both parents would like to work and the woman wants to go to work, but they have to put food on the table to pay the mortgage. And the mortgage that's created for them doesn't really exist anyway. You know, that's a rabbit hole for another conversation, but it's something I did a podcast on a few days ago with one guy who's a genius and one guy who found out the hard way about it all after being worth $500 million. There's just so many lies that, again, I see being revealed to people that whilst it would be painful, what that means is that we build something better for the future.
At the moment, we're building the prisons for our own enslavement, both mentally and physically, that will have even more of a devastating impact on future generations. The key point to understand is that the system gets built by us. It's vital that as many of us as possible invest in the world we want to live in. Can I confirm that you believe the agenda will collapse fairly soon?
Don't quote me on timelines, because I was pretty sure that when the First Minister of Wales said that you couldn't have a pint after 6 p.m. in the pubs in Wales, that people go, right, no, that's enough for me. Or I thought, you know, the D-dimer or graphene oxide, or there'd been so many times, but
I truly thought that 2 months of lockdown would bring this whole scam to a close. When that didn't happen, I was precautious about predicting the collapse of the narrative until I was quite certain that the jabbing of children would surely bring down the House of Cards. I'm no longer sure what it'll take to topple the system, but what I am sure of is it will come down.
My fear is obviously 6 months and up now as well. But these people, there will need to be accountability for the perpetrators. A public inquiry to whitewash it, you know, like the Iraq, and the, you know, that's not going to cut it this time. I don't think that's going to be acceptable to the British people when they find out more truth.
It's not like Iraq, where the tyranny was in some faraway land that few knew anything about. It should be much harder to conceal when the tyranny is happening on your doorstep.
Well, the communist playbook is, part of it is pressure on, pressure off. So, you know, don't be surprised if they reintroduce masking. What I'm saying is, don't surrender your bodily autonomy to an invasive, fraudulent test. Please don't cover your face with a mask that, if you think it's going to protect you, that's not what it's doing. It doesn't, for an aerosolized virus. And again, don't surrender to an experiment, especially keep your child, please, please, away from this. They've probably had it. They don't need it. They've never needed it. And it's just all risk. And then we build a much better world for ourselves.
We used to require proof that someone was sick. For example, a doctor's note to miss work. Now, one is assumed to be sick until one proves that one is healthy. For example, a test before visiting family. The default assumption is we're all sick. The criteria for what health is has been reversed. As a result of this reversal, the pharmaceutical industry has been exposed as the most callous, dangerous and corrupt force of wickedness in our world today. Since the NHS has advocated for this new health criteria, along with being hijacked by the pharmaceutical industry, it's safe to say that we urgently need a new direction for helping humanity heal and maintain optimum health. I know that you've worked in functional medicine and have been working for some time on ways to help patients recover from illness through a different approach. Can you share some of your thinking behind your vision of healthcare?
Pretty much all medicine, okay, is derived from plants. And I've recently started working with someone who's cultivated over 2,000 plants and has a kind of pure extraction process. And he even makes vapes, which I know the teenagers are going to love because it's got no chemicals or fillers in, but pure pine extract. Okay, and I've tried it, it's really good. But there's a better way, okay? If you want to think about what the WHO has done in the last 2 years, go back to the 80s when people were told to have a low-fat diet. Okay, so there's key vitamins. Vitamin D is one of them, which are fat soluble. You need fats in your diet. You need good, healthy fats in your diet. The big problem and the driver of many chronic diseases we see in the West is carbs and sugar, which fuel high insulin levels. And the insulin being this kind of growth promoter. And with time, our bodies become resistant to the effects of insulin, such that the cells of our body can't use the carbohydrate and sugars. And when you test someone's blood, they've got diabetes because the sugar's all there, it can't be utilized. So a lot of work I do is things like trying to reverse the effects of high insulin levels. I look at the role, and particularly with ILADS, that chronic infection plays in the development of chronic disease. So if you think about autoimmune conditions, you know, rheumatoid, all these arthritides, what's happening is that the immune system is mounting a response to an antigen of some sort, a bacteria or virus usually. Well, why can't we find that? Well, we can sometimes, quite often. So that's what I do. You know, I've got one young girl. She was 16 when she was diagnosed with RA, rheumatoid arthritis. She's 25 now. And I chatted to her and assessed her, and we said, well, let's do these tests and see what comes up. And there's a multitude of infections. And at the time when I first saw her, she'd just been put on what's called a biological drug, and she couldn't tolerate it. Her stomach was bad way. So we started treating these infections in her, and now she's off traveling. And she said to me, I just want to, at the first consultation, I want to go traveling, get married, settle down. After being traveling, of course. Yeah, and that's wonderful for me to see. And, you know, you see a lot of dietary issues, particularly as well with chronic pain. So we often see people with gut issues who have chronic pain, migraine issues. And there's this really important communication between our gut and our brain. If our gut's not working properly, and remember the microbiome, the bacteria, is accounting for about 70% of our immune system. So it needs to be in good shape. But if you're having this Western diet, it's not going to be usually. And yet the communication pathways is affected between the gut and the brain. And then you can get this sensitization in the central nervous system and people get chronic pain. It's really incredible. And you feel like when you're working with someone, you're going down the rabbit hole trying to find why they've been ill for 20 years. And they'll often say to me, oh, my bloods from my GP are normal. And that's because the GP's got access to different tests. And I've got access to different tests, but taking a whole different perspective on it. And then I saw a lady yesterday, and she's been ill 20 years. And I said, your bloods aren't normal. Here they are. She's like, you know, and I say, yeah, we're going to do this. And I try and do it kind of holistically, so we combine nutrition, sometimes it's meditation, sometimes work with other practitioners as well for healing. So it's a multifocal approach rather than just this is your medication to cover up the symptom of your disease. Because in doing so, we often create more disease longer term. statins are notorious. There is one particular serious consequence of statins. I'm not saying they don't have a role, but we do need fats to make hormones for our brain. It works better with, you know, we need fats. We have to be careful about our food in terms of reducing the processed food. The common inflammatory foods are foods like dairy, quite often, for a lot of people, because they contain a protein called casein, which a lot of people will react to. Okay, and other things, wheat is another one. You might not have celiac disease and be completely allergic to gluten, which causes celiac, but you might be intolerant. And sometimes what I'll do with people is an elimination diet, where for 3 weeks we go right back to basics, and then we do a slow reintroduction. We also do things like IgG antibodies for foods. So that will tell you not if you've got anaphylaxis, but if something you've eaten a few days ago has caused your symptoms today. So that's really helpful for chronic problems for people. And we see a wide range of things that come up. I see quite a few people with chronic fatigue syndrome, and they tend to do best, not always, but tend to do best on a diet that utilizes fats, predominantly healthy fats. And that seems to be that your brain, for most people, works better in fat burning mode or ketosis, healthy ketosis. Your insulin levels drop right down because you're not having lots of carb, which is not our ancestral diet by any means, which the body then sees as a stressor. Your cortisol level goes down, people sleep better as well. And so there's lots of different avenues to explore with patients based on what they're going through and experiencing. And it's less about saying, for me, you have this disease and condition, but looking ultimately at why they've got there. And usually I'll ask something like, you know, when did this happen? When, particularly if it was more of a sudden rather than a gradual thing. And sometimes it's something like, you know, it's when I have my house redecorated or a new kitchen put in and they've got all these fillers or glues that are actually causing toxic stress. So you get them to move out for a few days, put the heating on, do like what we call a burn off, and then move back in. Because often their test results for, you know, if you go to the doctor, they come up normal. So you've just got to, it's about thinking outside the box, really. It's fascinating, really.